This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's Resource Center. I'm Maya Tan. INSEAD's new book, Corporate Strategy, Tools for Analysis and Decision Making, co-authored by Fanish Puranam, INSEAD Professor of Strategy, helps corporate strategists tackle the big decisions that multi-business companies make, including the choice between retaining or divesting businesses, inorganic or organic growth, mergers, acquisitions or alliances, and directive or evaluative control by headquarters. I have Professor Fanish Puranam on the phone. He is the Roland Berger Chair Professor of Strategy and Organization Design and Academic Director of the PhD program at INSEAD. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
So, Professor, what's the thrust of this book?
This book is written to help people make corporate strategy decisions. And as you've outlined some of those decisions, there are others, including the choice between integration and non-integration in acquisitions, between alliance and acquisition, between organic growth and inorganic growth. And the purpose of the book is to help senior managers in a multi-business company make these decisions in an informed and logical manner, and also make them good consumers of the advice they get from consultants and bankers who help them often to make such decisions.
How different is this from classic business strategy, you know, where businesses look at what markets to enter into, barriers to entry, or what a company's core competency is?
So business strategy pertains to the decisions around a particular line of business, which has its own customers and competition and markets. Corporate strategy is the portfolio of different businesses. So if you take a typical family-owned business group in Asia, for example, it would be a combination of multiple individual businesses. So corporate strategy is really about the strategy at the portfolio level, which is to say which of these businesses belong in the portfolio, which ones don't, and how do you enter new businesses.
And are you looking at new tools in the book that aren't already being used?
Yes. In fact, there are several new frameworks and techniques in the book that are new to the world. These include mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive categorization of synergies. So synergies are a very important concept in multi-business strategy because they explain why the different businesses sit together in the portfolio. But for the most part, we don't have very good techniques for analyzing these synergies. So we've offered one in this book, which tries to do a good job of looking at all possible ways in which different value chains can be combined to create synergy. We have new tools to think about resource allocation. So just to give you an example, a very popular one that's currently used is the Boston Consulting Group's portfolio, which essentially uses differences in growth rates across businesses to make decisions on which ones to invest in. What's new about our approach is it takes into account the synergies between these different businesses, which was traditionally never taken into account. So we offer a new way of thinking about investing in one business, which takes into account the impact this will have on other businesses in the portfolio. So these are just two examples, but there are several others in the book.
What's the impact of synergies when done right?
When done right, synergies is what justifies the portfolio to exist, because in some sense, every individual shareholder could also assemble a similar portfolio through direct investment or through a fund manager. But synergies is what gives the license to exist for a multi-business firm.
Well, what are the biggest challenges faced by leaders the world over, which you address in this book?
So leaders of multi-business organizations are in every economy, right? There are practically no single business firms among the largest firms in any economy. Most economies, big firms are multi-business. So in some sense, they all face the same basic problem, which is how can we justify this layer of management over and above the individual businesses? So that's a common problem. But the big difference comes from the kind of market context they live in. So if you are competing in a market context with very efficient capital markets, for instance, North America or Western Europe, then the challenge for leaders is really about how can I create values in ways that mutual fund managers cannot or investors cannot. In other parts of the world, the challenge is, in addition to that, where can I look for opportunities to change my portfolio quickly, either through access to privileged information or being able to move very fast, or through having deep pockets. So the broad challenges are at a high level the same, but they do differ based on the kind of market context you're in.
Hmm. Do you have any case studies on a multinational or a multi-business company that has a good portfolio? And can you give us an idea of what the portfolio contains?
We can take examples from different contexts. So if you stick to the emerging economies context, and I'm quite familiar with multi-business group companies in India. So if you take the Tata Group, for example, it's a very large conglomerate with nearly 100 different companies in the portfolio. And a lot of these companies are very unrelated to each other. So they're in everything from software to hotels to spices and so on. But I think what holds it together is a corporate-level approach to thinking about the most important common resource, which is the brand, and how careful they are about how the brand is used by different parts of the businesses. In North American context, we might think about a conglomerate like Danaher or maybe Berkshire Hathaway, which is very much in the news because of Warren Buffett, their investor. In fact, a very interesting new conglomerate that we all know about is Google. So Google recently has changed their structure to now have a structure like a multi-business organization where the new entity is called Alphabet. And the old Google is just one of the businesses within Alphabet. And there are other parts of Alphabet which engage in very cutting-edge new technologies like life sciences, like space exploration, and so on. So essentially, from the investor's point of view, you're looking at a portfolio of different businesses through which you can extract returns from the market.
Can a portfolio contain two conflicting industries or businesses?
I think it's possible. It can even be a positive thing in the sense, if you think in the airline industry in the past, we've had examples where airlines have tried to have a full service and a low-cost carrier both in the same portfolio. The positives of this is that they end up stimulating each other through competition. The negatives are that often they can create so much organizational friction that neither of them do well. So the challenge is to maintain that separation very carefully by trying to run them in two different parts of the organization.
Well, you address different areas in the book. What's important to note when it comes to retaining or divesting businesses?
So one of the most interesting things about divesting businesses we discovered in the course of researching and writing this book, a lot of people seem to think that divestment is an admission of failure, that you only do it when clearly the business has not worked in the portfolio. This is incorrect. So it turns out actually that you can create a lot of value by successfully divesting to somebody who values your assets more than you do. And that's very possible because in a world in which firms have different bundles of resources, we may all value the same company differently because in combination with my remaining businesses, I may see more value in it. So even if I hold a business today and it's doing well, I think it's actually important for leaders of multi-business companies to constantly be looking for opportunities to find a buyer who may value this business more highly.
And there are companies who acquire businesses to profit from the act of divesting. Mm-hmm. So what happens when that's their business model?
So certainly private equity firms, I think, fit nicely into that category. Their business model is one of taking control of businesses which are either underperforming or performing poorly, and then turning them around and improving the way they function, and then selling the control rights on to another player. And that's how they make their money. So that is a business model for them. I think this model is harder if you're going for synergies between businesses. Because if you go for the synergies between businesses, then exiting any one business can have implications for the remaining businesses in the portfolio.
I'm speaking with Professor Fanish Puranam, the Roland Berger Chaired Professor of Strategy and Organization Design and Academic Director of the PhD program at INSEAD. He's also co-author of the book, of INSEAD's new book, Corporate Strategy, Tools for Analysis and Decision Making. When we come back, we're going to look at organic versus inorganic growth on Resource Center, BFM 89.9. In the world of manufacturing, how is the digital transformation going to affect you the most, and what is the biggest danger?
The biggest impact is going to be the connecting of all groups in a manufacturer's ecosystem. And number one, starting with the customer. How can customers connect to the core manufacturer? And that's going to be something that is extraordinarily important because there's a huge group of manufacturers that don't connect today with their end consumer. They sell products through distributors, they sell products through a variety of different retailers, and they don't have that clarity that's going to be had from this concept of connected manufacturing that's really driving this digital transformation.
To discover the six big things manufacturers need to know now, download the podcast of this episode of Resource Center featuring Sean Riley on www.bfm.my. Good afternoon. It's Resource Center and I'm Maya Tan. Today I'm speaking with Professor Fanish Purunam, the Roland Berger Chair, Professor of Strategy and Organization Design and Academic Director of the PhD program at INSEAD. He's also co-author of INSEAD's new book, Corporate Strategy, Tools for Analysis and Decision Making. So we've been talking about some of the different areas that the book covers. And one of the chapters looks at organic versus inorganic growth. Can you tell us what's pertinent in this area?
So by organic growth, we mean essentially making investments within the firm through hiring, through R&D, through new projects. And inorganic growth covers both the growth through alliances as well as through acquisitions. Now, the acquisition-based growth, the inorganic growth based on buying other companies, tends to get a lot of press. It's very popular because it makes news, right? But the point is that it's actually often extremely expensive to gain the control rights to other businesses. So organic growth is a very important alternative to consider, and the reasons why one may reject it in favor of inorganic growth largely have to do with speed. So the problem with organic growth is that if you begin the project today, it may take several years before an outcome is visible, and even then it's not guaranteed to succeed. With inorganic growth, you can buy somebody who's already been on this journey for longer than you have. So that's the usual trade-off in these cases. The risk and time required to build from scratch versus the higher cost of acquiring a ready-made solution.
What's your opinion on companies like Facebook who have done this quite successfully?
So companies like Facebook are, again, they get into the news for their very high visibility acquisitions. But in reality, they've also grown significantly through organic growth. And the two are very complementary for them. And their inorganic growth has helped to put them into new product categories or into new areas, which they might have found that trying to build something from scratch internally will just take too long.
And then a different sort of area would be mergers and acquisitions or collaborative ties. Can you tell us about that?
So one of the choices under inorganic growth, the very basic choice is, yes, we don't want to grow organically, but do we need to acquire a partner or can we work with them through partnership of some kind? And partnership itself can come in various flavors. It can be a contractual relationship, it can have an equity component, or it can be a joint venture. So these are all alternatives one has to consider. The big advantage of an acquisition is it gives you full control. So once the deal has been done, the acquirer gets to control the resources of the other side, which means they can restructure it, they can hire, they can fire, they can change the business strategy. With a partnership, you don't have that degree of control, but it's also much cheaper to set up. And the cost of failure is subsequently much lower. So even if it turns out the relationship has not been successful, exiting it is much easier. With an acquisition, this is much harder. So again, if I were to think about some of the myths that we found are quite prevalent when we were researching for this book, one of these that we saw is this belief that inorganic growth is really primarily about acquisitions. Mm. It's not. You should consider the alternative of a simple partnership.
Do you look at ethics as well in terms of acquiring businesses and creating monopolies in that sense?
Yes, I think this is very important, and when we teach our students at INSEAD, we certainly make this point very salient, that competition is very good. We believe that. That's why we are in a business school. But it's equally important to be ethical, and that means making sure not just that you obey the rules of the land, but also that you do what you believe to be morally correct. And this has a very big impact on decisions like, for instance, how to extract cost savings when you do an acquisition. We believe, for instance, I believe personally that it's quite reasonable to buy a company where the primary value is going to come from downsizing, but then it's extremely important to handle the downsizing process with not just legality, but with empathy and with ethicality. So it is important to be transparent, but it is equally important to be legal and ethical.
Well, looking at organic, inorganic growth, mergers, acquisitions, are there any don'ts in this area that you advocate?
So the belief that speed is what is driving one towards doing an acquisition or an alliance is quite common, but I think the real issue is not speed. It is about the time it would and the cost it would take to catch up. So one very simple thing to avoid is to only look at one alternative. Right? And we see this quite often. People talk about a corporate strategy and they say, we are going to choose whether to acquire this company or that. But that's only one choice. The other alternative could be to partner with it or to do an organic growth project of the same kind. So the key takeaway in this domain is always think about the road that you have not taken. There are other alternatives that you could have considered, and it's useful to come up with at least an approximate valuation of what those alternatives might have been.
And I guess it helps to sort of go back to synergies and looking at how it benefits all parties.
Correct. Synergies have to drive the logic for doing an acquisition or an alliance in most cases. Actually, we put it very simply in the book. Mm-hmm. Either you have to have a bargain or you have to have synergies. So right. A bargain means you know something about the true value of the business nobody else knows. So in that case, you could buy it and make money because nobody else knows its true value and you do. Now, that's increasingly unlikely, particularly as the markets become more efficient. So if you can't get bargains, you have to have synergies.
Another area that seems rather tricky is in directive versus evaluative control by headquarters.
Yes. So businesses can vary a lot in how their headquarters actually manage the different parts of the portfolio. We often say, people use the term that this headquarters is a strong headquarters or this one is a weak one. That's not very precise in our view. I think it's more useful to understand exactly how is the strength being exercised. So at one end, you can have a headquarters which says, we make the strategy for each of the businesses, and the business unit heads execute it. That could work, particularly if the headquarters is very, very knowledgeable about each of the businesses. But more typically, they won't be, because the businesses are many and they're diverse and so on. So a different approach would be to say, we let the business units make the primary decisions on strategy, but we only monitor their performance. So we exercise control on outcome, but not on the process.
You say that your book also addresses how business leaders can consider working with consultants and the advice that they provide.
Yes. I think one of the big concerns that both my co-author Bart and I have come across in this context is that very often the consultants and the bankers who are advising CEOs who are making these decisions, they're very sophisticated people. They know exactly what they're doing. And the CEOs often may neither have the time nor the depth of background knowledge to consider what are the alternatives to what's being suggested. So the analogy I sometimes give is like when you face a magician and he says, pick any card. You know, in reality, there's one card that they want you to pick. So you have to be smart enough to know what are the other cards in the pack and why are they not being shown to me. So in some sense, our book is really about making people smart enough to ask those questions.
And do you also provide advice to the smaller businesses who are being acquired? You know, can they also learn from your book?
Absolutely. I think if you are a target and which is being sought after either as a partner or as an acquisition target, the first question to ask is which is better for you? Because in some circumstances, actually giving up your autonomy and getting acquired may be better for you as a small company than being a partner. The reason is if you're a partner, some of your most important assets could be leveraged by your partnering company without your getting the full share of value. Whereas if you get acquired, yes, you lose control, but you cash out the value right up front. So thinking through the same sort of logic that the acquirer is doing, but from the other direction, can be very helpful for the small company.
Are there any common mistakes that are being made in this sphere?
They range in size and number across these different contexts. So in the case of growth, I think common mistakes are avoiding the alternative. In the case of acquisition, it is not taking into account the difficulty of post-merger integration. In the case of resource allocation between businesses, the common problem is not taking into account synergistic effects between businesses. In the case of organic growth versus inorganic growth, it is not trying to compute the value of doing a project organically before accepting an external partner. So I believe there are common myths and mistakes in each one of these domains.
Mm. You mentioned something about post-merger relations. What are the issues that often come up there?
So a good analogy to think about this, Maya, would be if you bought a house versus you bought a company, right? The difference between buying the two is once you've bought the house, you can effectively use it very quickly without making major changes. When you buy a company, you're buying a group of people, or rather you're buying the legal rights to control the decisions of a group of people. So if the people don't understand, appreciate, and get on board with the logic for why you bought the company, you may have legally acquired the company, but there is no value in it. So this makes mergers and acquisitions very, very complicated, which means that there are at least two implications. One, at the time of valuing the company, when you decide how much to pay in dollars, there has to be an attempt to understand how will these soft issues of people and culture and relationships, how will they play out after the deal? Because if one suspects that the best people will not like working for the new employer, then paying a large price upfront makes no sense. Second, there is an entire category of expertise around HR, around culture, which is actually very important in corporate strategy, but currently doesn't have enough of a voice. But this is extremely important if we want to do these kind of things well.
Just to wrap up, what are the top considerations then that are covered in your book?
So this book is really written for decision makers in the corporate headquarters of a multi-business company, and they cover very fundamental questions of what should be in the portfolio, how should I change the portfolio, and how should I organize the relationship between headquarters and the businesses. The book is not a substitute for having to rely on external consultants. That will still happen. Both bankers and consultants will be necessary. But the book will make you an informed consumer of their advice.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Fanish Puranam, the Roland Berger Chair Professor of Strategy and Organization Design and Academic Director of the PhD program at INSEAD, also co-author of the book, Corporate Strategy, Tools for Analysis and Decision Making. This has been Resource Center. I'm Maya Tan for BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.